presentation.
Is it time?
It's time.
It's time.
Last call. Rusty present to win. Today, all we have are CDs. Three from Steve Turnage, two from Dan, courtesy of Hear Music.
Too late to put your name in?
No. And Dan tells me that it's a sad report, Hear Music is history. So the parent company decided to get back to their core competency of hustling coffee.
These may be the last CDs we'll see. I won't promise that.
Well, maybe they have, you know, tons of surplus in their warehouse, but they can't.
They moved it to California. Oh. The functions are in California.
I see. Draft.
Yeah, that's
good. That way too convenient.
Yeah, really.
Lindsay, would you do the honors?
Adam Jenkins.
Wow.
That's a good house deal.
How do you do that? How about... there. Jellyfish.
Thank you.
You should have been the president for
him. Do you want a pen? There you got one.
Oh, I see these.
Steve T.
Of course. Him gone.
President to win.
Bye again.
Rick Chen.
Choose C for me.
Uh-oh.
Oh, I already have the jellyfish one.
Okay. How about that?
Mm-hmm. I already have that one.
Well, gosh, then I guess.
Okay,
so.
Well, then I'll recuse myself.
How about that one?
I have that.
How about that one?
Okay.
Some people are hard to please.
Yeah.
Which one do you go?
The Posies.
Rob Baum.
That's me.
Ah, yes.
Thank you. I have none of them, so I'll take whatever you got. Thank you.
Two left. Tactile experiment.
Steve McAtee.
Oh, yeah. Works.
McCartney?
Yeah, that works.
Sir Paul?
Oh, yeah.
Who has a new girlfriend?
We can only hope.
He doesn't marry her.
Maybe he's learned his lesson. Hope springs eternal.
That's me. Well, there are only this many people here, so what did I get?
Monterey Pop.
Oh, wow.
Cool.
That's actually a nice CD.
Yeah.
Okay, Mark, the floor is yours.
I have some slides on noise control, noise and vibration control. Some of the people are concerned about the time we can go through them, or we can just have people ask questions. If you want to leave, I won't be embarrassed if you do so. Do you want to go through the slides, or should we just have a quick Q&A on that subject?
I'm ready for the slides.
Let everybody speak at once.
Yeah.
Want to do the slides?
Yep.
Okay. One of the terms we don't like is the term soundproof. Nothing is soundproof, no such thing. There's also a problem in that people, and I mentioned it earlier, people think you can improve the transmission by covering all the walls and surfaces that have a high noise reduction coefficient, which almost never does any good because things that have high noise reduction coefficients still transmit, are still fairly transparent to sound in most cases. If you don't believe me, pull out a piece of this stuff or a chunk of fiberglass and talk through it and you'll see it isn't quite good grill cloth, but it's still, most of the sound just goes right through it. Okay, some terminology. Sound transmission class is what you want to look at if you're trying to isolate the sound between two rooms, whether it's through a wall, a ceiling assembly, or a floor assembly. It's a single number descriptor indicating the transmission characteristics. It considers a range of frequencies, so in from that sense it's sort of like the NRC where it averages some things. The way it's calculated is more complicated than for NRC, and I won't go into that, but an important point is it does not properly deal with low frequencies. It only goes down to 125 hertz. So if you are concerned with bass going through the wall, STC in and of itself won't tell the whole story. You need to look at the transmission loss at the lower frequencies, which are not included in the STC rating. There's another descriptor called field sound transmission class, which is like STC, only STC defines a procedure for measuring this characteristic in an acoustical laboratory. FSTC is a similar calculation from measurements made in the field. In practice, FSTC is always lower than STC by maybe 5 or 10 dB. These things are also changing. FSTC has been replaced by what's now called ASTC, which most people have never heard of, and we predict that the FIIC, IIC being an impact isolation class, which is for footfalls and impact sounds, or that cart I told you about running around the food corridor at the hotel, this will probably also be replaced by an AIIC, I suppose. Sound isolation. You can sort of imagine that you will increase transmission loss of a wall by making it more massive. That makes sense. If the wall's made out of concrete instead of feathers, it's going to have a better transmission loss, even if they're both equally airtight. But surface weight in and of itself doesn't tell the whole story, except for a monolithic construction such as poured concrete or a wall made of straw or something like that. Apparently they actually do that. They make houses out of straw. Anybody seen that?
Yeah.
Anybody ever measured one? I'm really curious to know what the acoustics are like.
Apparently they're pretty dead.
It's sprayed with concrete, isn't it?
Well, I think sometimes they plaster it, but others I've seen, it appears they leave them bare, so I don't know. The question I have is what happens when it catches on fire?
Yeah.
It's so compressed that it's almost unburnable. It's like a folded-up newspaper. You can't burn it.
Well, I'm not convinced.
Mud.
Ah.
Yeah.
A single wall, meaning just a single surface, provides relatively poor insulation and also has the problem that given its geometry, thickness, and but even more so length and width, it's going to resonate at certain frequencies. This is the problem with the pane of glass. Glass is actually not that bad, except that at some frequencies, a group of frequencies that are harmonically related, it's going to resonate. And at those frequencies where it resonates, the glass is almost an open window, which is why we hear that train right now.
Train's loud enough, we'd hear it.
Well, the train's loud enough, we'd hear it anyway, but most of that mid-frequency stuff we're hearing is coming through the glass. And if you listen carefully, it sounds like an inverse comb filter, because the frequencies that where it's resonating are probably an octave apart. The basic principle for creating relatively lightweight walls that have high transmission loss is a solid septum separated by airspace, preferably with fuzzy stuff inside that's absorptive, followed by another septum. Now, ideally, each of the septums would be very stiff and very massive. The airspace would be very large and completely absorptive. That would be the ideal condition. Well, you could build a wall made out of 12 inches of concrete and 24 inches of airspace with fiberglass in it and another 12 inches of concrete, and that'd be a pretty good wall. In fact, I actually measured such a wall once where in a, can't remember where it was, someplace around here, they had two band rooms back to back, and we were trying to achieve STC 70 or something insane like that, and we got it. In fact, that wall was designed by Roy Richards, who was the co-author of one of the books that I mentioned. But that's an unusual thing. Usually you're working with 2x4s and gypboard because that's what real rooms are built out of, and that's conventional building materials of ordinary cost. So what you want to do is make two walls, essentially, that have separate framing systems. This would be the skinniest thing you could do with 2x4s placed staggered. This is wider. That's better yet. But the idea is a solid septum, then airspace with absorption, then another septum. Rigidity is also important, and you can read that for yourself. I'm going to try to go through this quickly. What about resilient channels? How many people have heard of RC1? Oh, at least one person. This was developed, I think, by U.S. Gypsum originally. Is that right? Adam, do you remember the story? Basically, it's a channel, a piece of metal that looks like this. You mount this part to the structure, and then you mount this part, the gypboard, to this part. The idea is that it flexes. It's supposed to solve all your problems, give you a really high STC. If you see any of this or somebody says they're going to use this, run screaming in the opposite direction. There are two problems with this, maybe three. One is they don't make it. The company that used to make this, U.S. Gypsum, doesn't make it anymore, and all of the copies are kind of either clones or fakes, to take your pick. Most of them aren't this good. And there's actually a lot of genuine fakes, stuff that looks like this but isn't as flexible. Secondly, the problem is if this is on the wall, somebody hangs a picture, by putting a nail through there, and nail happens to touch the structure behind, you've just thrown your money away. It shorts out the isolation. So we don't think much of this stuff, even in theory, but there are some isolating systems. Here's a couple of them if anybody wants to come up and look at them, that do work pretty well, that enable you to isolate a gypboard wall or ceiling from the structure. This is actually where most things fail, not because they chose a bad wall construction, but it has holes in it, so to speak. Things that will compromise it, breach the isolating value, conduit and pipe can't have that. It will either short out the wall by coupling the two surfaces together, or there will be a leak there which will admit sound all the way through, or both. Ductwork, recesses and niches, like for your speakers, for instance. Relights, glass is not good. Light fixtures, this thing here is a huge leak in this ceiling. This ceiling isn't very good to start with, but this light fixture is acoustically a big hole. I'm not going to spend any time on these, but we'll put the slides up and you can look at this, but this illustrates how sound can leak through places where the gypboard doesn't come all the way down and there's no caulking here. You would think that those little microscopic cracks are of no consequence, and they are not. They often are the predominant source. These little seemingly insignificant leaks are actually the determinant of how good the STC of your wall is. And that is the difference between the field FTC and the laboratory one. It can cost you 5-10 points. Flanking can occur through ceilings where you have this kind of a ceiling, but the wall over there stops at the ceiling instead of going all the way to the structure here. If you look carefully here, you'll see that here this soffit wall goes all the way up and the ceiling stops there, but sometimes to save money, they build the ceiling first and then put the wall under it. Major leak. You could have some doors or windows that are adjacent and can cause sound to travel between two spaces. Here's where two light fixtures are too close together, leaks through the first fixture up into the plenum through the second one. Ductwork is also called a speaking tube. Big speaking tubes. And often overlooked, but frequently your best way of creating isolation is just with the layout. Don't put a classroom next to the mechanical room. Put the locker room in between them, or the bathrooms. Well, bathrooms would be a poor choice, but put something quiet in between the noisy space and the quiet space, with this thing in between being a space you don't care if it's noisy. Don't put the band room and the choral room next to each other. Put something in between them. And actually here, practice rooms might be a bad example because you probably care about these, or maybe you're never going to use these when these are in use, and that's okay. I thought this was an interesting one, and it came up once as to whether we might do a AES meeting there. This was a real problem. Como wanted to put in a studio, and because of the way the layout of the building was, they wanted to land a helicopter on top of the studio, right on the roof of the studio. And they didn't want to... What in the world happened to that slide? Well, there's some extra stuff in that slide. Pay no attention to the small print. In addition to that, they wanted to build the studio control room with a window on the outside right next to the monorail line. I mean, like 5 feet from it. And the question is, can they do that? Well, the answer is yes, but it cost them. But they paid and it works. They can land the helicopter on the roof and you cannot hear it in the studio. And the monorail, you can stand on the... stand right in front of that window and the monorail goes swooshing by and you can't hear a thing and you're going, what's wrong with my hearing? It's rather unnerving. But that window is a very expensive construction, with one of the panes being 4-inch laminated glass. Just one of the panes.
What does it have to do to isolate the helicopter?
Julie told me. I didn't do the design. I think there were several inches of concrete on the roof, then a large airspace, then several layers of gypboard on springs, another large airspace, several more layers of gypboard on another set of springs, I believe was the basic construction. And by the way, it didn't work the first time because the contractor made some changes that they didn't tell anybody about, as a result of which all the springs bottomed out because the ceiling weighed more than it was supposed to, and then the contractor tried to hide it. But our boss, who's a little woman about this high, was very persistent and forced the contractor to cut a hole in the ceiling so she could look at it, and they took it down and fixed it, and then it did work. Pardon?
They changed the springs or changed the weight of the ceiling?
The weight of the ceiling was higher than the original design. So they put in the springs that were specified, but they turned out...
No.
Hello.
Oh, it's probably on a timer so that...
How do I turn it back on?
On a system timer.
It's blinking.
Is it blinking?
No, it's in a cold down cycle. I bet it's an auto turn off.
Since we had a second shift, we started going off 5:30.
We are not having a good day. Is there an AV man in the house?
You know, I bet it's the projector. As soon as it stops flashing, I'll press the button.
Send it. There's a control system.
Yeah, it's flashing. I think it will come back on in a minute.
Or is that a cool down cycle?
That's a cool down.
Well, I'm looking at the flashing light over here.
Oh, okay.
Is the computer still on?
Can I
sell it now?
Can it turn blue first?
All right, it's ready.
Fire up. Okay.
On
here. Is it coming on?
No, it powered off.
Oh, there it goes. Okay.
We have life. You'll be glad to know we don't have any better life with that than the glasses we have here.
We should have an image. Let me see.
Was. It flashed up for a second.
Oh,
there it is.
There we are. Okay. Impact isolation is different than sound isolation in that with impact isolation we're concerned about physical impact. Usually it's a footfall problem or the case of the cart rolling across the tile floor that we don't want to hear is something where some kind of motion of persons or machinery or material is impacting the floor. Actually, it doesn't have to be the floor, but it usually is, inducing vibration into the floor, which is re-radiated somewhere as sound. Usually, that's a matter of making the floor soft and squishy in some way. Carpet is usually the fix. You can't put carpet in the kitchen of a restaurant. So in that case, you use a resilient underlayment or something like that. That's what was left out of the floor in that hotel project I mentioned. Actually, that was supposed to have what's called a floating floor, and it was VE'd out. VE is a acronym for value engineering. Which has nothing to do with value, it has to do with cutting costs in most cases. Here's a chart of some commercially available underlayments. I won't go over that. This is just a picture of an interesting isolation problem at a hospital. These are big ducts, and you'll see that each of these things is standing on four springs, two on each side, with fairly high deflection. I don't remember what these are, but I think they were 4 inches of deflection. That's a whole interesting story. Okay, that's self-evident. Let's go on to mechanical noise. The mechanical systems, it's too bad we have to have heat and stuff because these guys cause all the problems. Part of our company does mechanical engineering, so I feel safe in saying that. They're often the dominant source of sound and vibration within a building, as well as as well as one of the major sources of flanking and leakage paths through the walls and ceiling assemblies. Two things to be careful of when you're talking about this: the difference between sound power level and sound pressure level. You may recall from the talk about decibels, about whether it's 10 log the ratio or 20 log the ratio. That's what we're talking about here. These are analogous to power in watts and voltage as pressure. it's fairly difficult to measure sound power, and actually you can't measure it directly, at least not in the field. You have to measure it indirectly by measuring the sound pressure level, and they're doing a bunch of calculations. The reason I'm bringing this up is you have to be careful when you're looking at the data that the manufacturers give you. If they give you a sound pressure level, like manufacturers who make video projectors always specify the noise level as so many dBA SPL. That's an absolutely meaningless number unless they've given you a whole bunch of information. A, was that measured in a anechoic chamber or outdoors? Was it measured in a room? If so, what is the room constant? At what distance was it measured and at what frequency? And where was it measured? It's going to be louder off the side that has the exhaust port than on the other side. Which side did they measure? I don't know. If you have a sound power level, which for mechanical equipment you often can obtain, then you have a number that you can use to make calculations because you know how much energy you're actually going to put into the space, and you can calculate the sound pressure level at some place within that space or downstream at the in another room fed by that duct or whatever. We think of signal-to-noise ratio as an electrical thing because that's what we're used to doing, but there's always a signal-to-noise ratio acoustically, too. And it isn't, there's actually two or three ways of thinking of it. In effect, the direct reverberant ratio, which is sometimes expressed as percent all cons or something like that, is in fact a signal-to-noise phenomenon. You have the direct sound and the early reflections, and a ratio between that and the late reflections and the reverberation tail, plus the ambient noise of the room, all that stuff is not useful to intelligibility, so that becomes like a signal-to-noise ratio. But you also have the simple signal-to-noise ratio of the level of the signal of interest compared to the ambient noise level of the room. If that's 10 dB, you might have a problem. If that's 100 dB, well, you have a miracle. Usually it's somewhere in between. You may have heard the term NC. This room is NC something or other. I think Ben Arroyo Hall claims to be NC 20 or, is it 20?
20 or lower.
Yeah.
It's lower than that.
It can't be too much lower, but it might be. These are the NC curves. These have been around for a long time. each curve describes a weighting that gives more emphasis or essentially de-emphasis to the higher frequencies. In other words, it allows a higher level at the low frequencies, and that makes sense because at the low frequencies our ears are less sensitive. In fact, you'll see they bear a vague resemblance to the Fletcher-Munson curves, and that's not accidental. They just don't have all the squiggles in them. NC.
Is that an average, that your average has to be that, or nothing can exceed that curve?
That's a good question, and I'm going to come back to that.
Okay.
NC was developed in 1957. Then they came out with preferred noise criteria, which if you look at the NC curve, it doesn't go down very low. It quits looking at the data at 63 hertz and at 8,000 hertz. So if somebody said, well, gee, we need to go lower and higher than that. So they did that and called it preferred noise criteria. Then somebody discovered it was costing small fortunes to meet these criteria. So 10 years later, they came out with room criteria, which was a little more restrictive. And then after that, they came out with what they called balanced noise criteria, which is probably the best set of all, but the fact is nobody uses any of those. Everybody still uses the old-fashioned NC curve. And also, balanced noise criteria is usually known as NCB, not BNC, because somebody objected to that sounding like a coax connector. The curves are all essentially similar in shape, but they have different extents and different slight differences in the curve shape. These are some typical NC values that might be recommended for different kinds of spaces, like in a toilet room. We don't care if it's too noisy, and actually many toilet rooms are lots higher than that. In a theater or a recording studio or a concert hall, you'd want NC20 or maybe even a little better. This is expensive, very expensive. I don't know what we're at in here, but not NC30, I can tell you that. Listen to the roar of that. There's some kind of a machine right out over there. I can hear it.
Sounds like it's back there from here.
Does it? No, this is HVAC machinery, what I'm hearing.
So getting the fan from the...
And you guys right there are hearing the fan and the projector. But what I'm hearing is some big air handler up there somewhere, probably over the corridor. It's not NC30. Pardon?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what I'm hearing, I don't think is duct-borne. Yes, it is. Anyway, this room is not as quiet as it should be, in my opinion, for a classroom. There are two solutions to the train problem. Either spend an extra $1 million on the building, don't put the building here, or move the train. Three solutions, I guess. The train's almost unsolvable, and I imagine that if there was an acoustician involved, the decision was that we'll put up with that. Doesn't happen all the time. But sometimes, like at Benaroya, the train actually goes under Benaroya. I think it's almost directly underneath, isn't it, Rick?
It kind of
the tunnel
corner goes through a corner.
Okay, they spend a lot of extra money to isolate that building and especially the hall itself from the vibration of the train, and that works. But that's a concert hall. This is a classroom building. I don't know. Even ears that are experienced are not very good at measuring, but probably. A couple of things some of you may not be aware of. Maybe you've heard of it and thought maybe it didn't apply to you, and it actually does, although I'm not aware of very much enforcement activity in our industry. But OSHA's kind of gone, at least since Ronald Reagan and Mr. Bush, but WSHA is still alive and well. And there are regulations about workplace noise, and they apply to musicians too. That's a workplace. And they're fairly stiff, at least for us. If it's over 90 for more than 8 hours, you got to wear hearing defenders. That's the law. If it's over 110, you get a half hour and that's it. That's the law. And that's A-weighted, by the way, not flat. And if it's 115, you're only allowed 15 minutes in that environment without some kind of hearing protection. Many years ago, just before OSHA became law, I put a paging system in a boiler room where the ambient was 115. That system would be illegal today. Now, we were paging, those people did wear hearing defenders, and we were paging through them, but the paging levels were like 130. I want to be there when somebody does this. I once did mixed monitors for, can't remember whose drummer it was, but the guy kept insisting he couldn't hear his own kick drum, and we ended up with two 12-inch side fills right here. Here's his head. Here's these two side fills. hooked up to a kilowatt apiece, and the clip light, every time he'd stomp the kick, the clip light would go boink, 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 boink. And he still couldn't hear it. And I finally explained to him that the reason he couldn't hear it is because he was deaf, and he was deaf because of these darn monitors he wore. He didn't buy it, though. Mechanical equipment generates noise and vibration, and to combat the vibration, you need to isolate it, which means some combination of spring isolators or rubber isolators or something, and usually extra mass is placed. This depicts a frame with a concrete pad on which the machine is placed just to increase the mass to make the to deflect the springs a little more and to increase the vibration. Sound power data is what you want to look for. How to do these calculations is kind of beyond our scope tonight. Sound is not blown down the duct by the moving air. It also is not moved by the wind outside. Sound goes 1,100 feet per second, roughly. And if you have that high a velocity in your duct, you've got extra problems besides sound transmission. Similarly, if the wind is blowing 1,100 miles an hour, there's an additional problem there.
Well, that would only be 700 miles an hour.
Yeah. Now, airflow can cause pressure gradients that can cause funny things to happen, but generally the sound just goes down the ductwork the same whether the fan is running or not. And you don't want the sound to go through the air grill, through the duct, and into the next room. That's not good. How do you stop that? Well, some combination of duct liner, which is where you take compressed fiberglass, not unlike, not unlike what this stuff is made, although for some reason duct liner is always black. I don't know why, that's tradition, I guess. Apparently. But just provide some absorption on the inside of the duct. Can also be useful for thermally insulating the sidewall of the duct. Is not always very popular because, especially for fiberglass stuff, because there can be environmental issues with microscopic pieces of the fiberglass falling off and blowing around through the air. That's a separate problem. You can use sound traps, which is a section of a duct that's commercially manufactured with some sort of absorbent material with it. It's an off-the-shelf product that's made in a factory and then installed as a section within the ductwork. You can read that for yourself, I guess. It's the first, as with any kind of insulation, the first few feet or the first few inches gives you the greatest benefit. There's a law of diminishing returns where if you, and this is true thermally or sound-wise, the first inch gives you quite a bit of value, and then to get a significant amount, you've got to double or triple the amount to get a greater benefit. If you've already got 10 feet of lining, another 10 feet of lining doesn't double the number of decibels of loss that you get. This shows how some traps are made internally. Sometimes the sound is not, the noise is not the sound of the air handling unit coming down the duct and emerging through the holes in the grill. Sometimes the sound is actually generated right here by the grill itself because of the airflow through it. Now, what I'm hearing here, I don't believe is that case, but you've probably all been in a room once or twice where you notice that there's an air grill making a whistling sound. That's regeneration noise. That's not coming from the fan in the furnace that's being generated by the grill itself because the velocity is too high through the grill. Or it's a really lousy grill, one or the other. And that's called regeneration noise. These are some general criteria for what the velocities in a system should be for reasonably quiet conditions. This is for NC30. If you're doing a studio and you want 20, it's got to be even lower than that, like maybe a couple of hundred, 150, 200. Crosstalk we talked about a little earlier, but that's the condition where sound goes through the air grill, into the duct, down to the next room, out the other air grill. A duct is just a big speaking tube if it's not treated in some way to prevent that. Someone's likely to bring up the idea about active noise control. Does anybody know what that is? How many people are familiar with the Bose Quiet Comfort noise canceling headphones? My wife has decided I must purchase a pair of these for her.
You can just take a Sharpie and black out the Bose part and it won't feel so bad.
Well, maybe. I think I have to put duct tape over it.
There's other brands too.
Yeah, but unfortunately I think they actually don't work as well. But does anybody know? I don't have experience directly.
I have a set of JVCs I use at work.
And you like them?
Yeah.
Oh.
I have some Sennheisers that are pretty nice.
Sennheisers are really good.
Yeah.
I have some that I use on airplanes.
Anyway, the basic idea is that if you, in this case, you have a fairly small room here, that you have this cavity you create by placing earphones over or on your ear. And if you put a sensing microphone there and detect the ambient level in real time that's present, you can then tell some amplifying circuitry to invert that signal and apply it to the transducer and effectively cancel the noise out. Sounds like a simple theory. In practice, it's pretty difficult to get it to work except at low frequencies. But it turns out that, especially on airplanes, most of the noise is at fairly low frequencies, so it actually can work fairly well. Well, they make similar things to actively cancel the noise in ductwork, which sounds like a tremendously nice idea because it's a lot cheaper than all of the other things. The trouble is, if you think about it, it really only works at the very low frequencies as a function of the physical size of the duct, because canceling by that method presumes that that space is acting like a cavity. Remember what I talked about earlier, where because of the wavelength at the frequency of interest, the enclosure has no reflections. The pressure at any given instant is the same every place because the wavelength is much bigger than the size of the enclosure. If that's true, that's when you can actively cancel a noise that's occurring within that space. Nevertheless, active noise control can work in ductwork to deal with very low frequency rumbles, and sometimes that's a good way to go. By itself, it's usually not enough, but if you have a low-frequency problem, that might be part of the solution. One of the things you don't want to see is anything bolted to the floor. What you do want to see is it isolated from the floor so that as this jiggles and shakes, it does not drive those vibrations or create motion in the floor. A simple concept, but fairly difficult to apply. Vibration isolation can take several forms. It can be some kind of resilient material, cork or rubber, or compressed glass fiber. It could be a spring. The more the deflection, the greater the degree of isolation. One thing you have to watch out for, especially with springs, is that all of these things have a resonant frequency, and if the resonant frequency happens to be the same, the same or close to the frequency of the noise you're trying to isolate, you have a problem. Because then the isolator that's supposed to isolate it will actually amplify it, and the whole thing becomes like a big tank circuit. And in extreme cases, your machine can start hopping across the floor. Some things to watch out for if you go into a space where there's a problem, or maybe it's your room and, gee, you spent a lot of money on an acoustician to design it right and you're sure the mechanical was a good guy. Take a look at the isolators. You may find that if the isolators were installed at the factory, they always bypass them with bolts so that the machine doesn't shake itself apart in the shipping truck. Well, the installers usually don't take those bolts out, so your springs aren't doing anything. Make sure that the inertial block isn't sitting on top of a beer can or a crescent wrench or something like that. And don't laugh. We find that in probably half the cases where we go out and inspect a job where there's a noise problem. Something's shorting out the springs. Sometimes the thing shorting it out is not debris, but a piece of electrical conduit or a water pipe or Lord knows what. Sometimes it's a brace that the inspector wanted somebody to put on because he was afraid that the system wasn't sufficiently braced. You can read that for yourself. And again, be wary of what the salesman tells you, and be cautious about what's on the data sheet. And be especially cautious when they say it's silent or whisper quiet or something like that. Those are meaningless terms, and it's usually not even close to true where that's being used. What you want to see is a real-world number, a value, and with the conditions of test specified. Some books that I find useful, one that I mentioned is written by Lee Irvine and Roy Richards. Nice thin book. I always like thin books because it takes less time to read them. And feel free to come up and take a look at these. This is available on Amazon. David Egan wrote a book called Architectural Acoustics that's quite useful. This is the second edition. This one's targeted at architects, but has a lot of good stuff in it. Charles Salter's office publishes a book simply called Acoustics. They're actually one of our competitors in the Bay Area, but they're a good acoustical consulting firm, and this is a nice book. A couple of other books that I find useful. This is actually Lindsay's copy. I think I stole this from your shelf, didn't I?
Yeah.
This is Newell's book, Recording Studio Design. I think some of you may have seen this. There's some good stuff in here specific to studios. And a book that's kind of outdated and seemingly a little unsophisticated, but I think it's quite valuable, is Everest's book. Called Sound Studio Construction on a Budget. I don't know if this is still in print. I think it's not. Does anybody know? I didn't look.
I don't think it is. Tap Books, right?
Yes.
I'm pretty sure it's still out there.
Some of these, if they're not in print, you can get them from eBay and for those of us that are addicted to that.
For real cheap.
There's a lot of good information on the internet. As with any other topic, there's even more BS on the internet. But one site that's quite useful is RPG, who's the manufacturer of various kinds of acoustical wall panels. The URL is rpginc.com. a lot of good white papers there, and in general, their data is reliable, their products are good, but expensive. And what else have we got?
The owner of and the brains behind RPG has also published a lot of papers.
Yes, Dr. Peter D'Antonio is one of my heroes. And when he speaks, I like to listen. Sometimes I have a hard time following him because he can get fairly gory with the math. But it's always worth studying whatever he's said or written. You can always call me, and thanks for coming. Any questions? Everyone's asleep, I can see it. Okay, thanks for coming on. Rick's
so
got a question.
You have a sample of that white fibrous tectum. I've heard that that's the stuff that fell from the kingdom ceiling.
Yes, actually, it is. This is what was on the original kingdom. I think those were one-inch panels, covered the entire dome. And this stuff is fairly hefty. And the stuff on the roof of the kingdom was saturated with water, which is why it fell off. So that's why everybody freaked out, because they had 4x8 sheets of this stuff saturated with water coming down on who knows whom. I don't think anyone was hit, but it would not have been a good thing if they had been. What they did was they took all that off and replaced it with a spray-on product called K13, which is a sort of looks like, from a distance, it looks like spray-on concrete. What's the name of that stuff?
Ferrocement.
Gunite, thank you. But if you go up and touch it, it's soft and fairly squishy, and it's actually a cellulose fiber, not unlike spray-in cellulose insulation, except that it's has a mixed with a binder, and it hardens to form a solid surface, but fairly porous.
Is that what they spray on I-beams and stuff?
No, that's usually a fire insulation, and that's usually hard. Sometimes they use stuff that's a little soft and friable, but it's not the same.
But it doesn't matter if there's a hard surface over it, the softness doesn't really give you that, essentially.
Right.
Until you scrape it off by all the rigging.
You get a little bit of absorption right in that spot, but none of that can do you much good.
The K13 that they put on the kingdom was the largest spraying job they had ever done. And that's a big ceiling. Yeah. It's all one piece. Yeah. And then they blew it up.
I can't let your comment that the wind doesn't affect sound pass without...
Oh, I didn't say that. I said the wind as such doesn't blow the sound away. In fact, since you bring it up, I'll explain a little more. What wind does is create pressure gradients. And it's the pressure gradients that cause the sound to appear to move. It doesn't move, it bends. The pressure gradient actually acts like a lens. But the sound does not get blown away by the wind. It certainly appears that way, but wind that's going even 100 miles an hour is not going to appreciably alter the course of propagating sound. But what will alter the course is the pressure gradient that the wind creates as it blows around objects and even the ground. A pressure gradient will exist between the ground and the
heat pressure gradient.
Yeah.
The pressure gradient you get from heat or from snow. Mm-hmm. Snow absorbs. The one reason why snow sounds so quiet is it curves the sound down, so it keeps hitting the snow, and the snow is relatively absorptive. So
if it's not icy, yeah.
Yeah, that's why. When it's snowing, it's so quiet. The snow is relatively absorptive, but if you didn't have the pressure gradients, it wouldn't really make very much difference. It's not that much more absorptive than, say...
No, the wind will definitely mess with you, especially outdoors, but it's not that the wind itself is blowing the sound around as if as a current might move the water around because the wind isn't fast enough to do that in any, at least on planet Earth. But the pressure gradients that the wind creates definitely will move the sound, cause the sound to propagate unexpectedly.
And related to that, I do the sound at the Woodland Part 2 concerts in the summer, and I have some issues with the sound propagating into the neighborhood. And I've gotten approval to do non-intrusive measurements of the temperature and humidity and stuff. And I'm wondering if anybody in this group has the ability to measure temperature, humidity, and barometer over distance and record it into a computer over time.
I don't know.
Hmm?
Yeah. To make that work, you need to measure fairly high off the ground, at the ground, and a whole bunch of things. That'll be an interesting thing. There are some.
Also, crowd produce a lot of heat, which changes things a great deal.
Yeah. I used to do the sound at an outdoor, in an outdoor 10,000 seat outdoor arena that was a rodeo, held in Idaho in July from mid-afternoon till about midnight. Well, that time of year when the thing starts, the temperature, air temperature is 100, 105 degrees, and by midnight the air temperature can be as low as 60. But meantime the ground is still pretty warm, and you can get some really weird stuff going on there from temperature gradients. And if you get a little wind that day, it's even more squirrely. The announcer would frequently complain that this sounded like a barrel of snakes or some such technical descriptor.
I've been trying to research it on the internet, and the microclimates that AtmoSci people are interested in are miles in size. They're interested in tens of feet.
There's also some new legislation that you will be interested in, and some others may be. In fact, our boss is on the committee that is preparing that legislation that will deal with nighttime entertainment sounds, and it's fairly restrictive. It's going to be a lot of unhappy people. It's targeted at nightclubs, but it will affect everybody who's doing performances at night.
Nighttime defined as what?
I think after 7 p.m. 7 p.m.?
After 10 p.m.
10 p.m., pardon me.
It's the existing.
Which is the current standard also, there's a change at 10 p.m.
Yeah.
Now.
In fact, the current standards are pretty restrictive too, although probably not fully enforced, at least for entertainment things.
Randomly enforced, I think. It's
That's probably a better way to put it.
Where can I find out about that?
You could email me and I'll send you what information we have. It's in flux. There's nothing been decided. Adam knows more about that than I do.
It's codified. You're still working.
I don't think it's been passed yet, but I think there is a draft.
Pardon? City thing or county thing?
That's city of Seattle. The state also has some criteria which has been adopted by some cities and not by others. The worst ones, in my mind, are the cities who say, well, you can't be a nuisance. I mean, how do you define that? What's a sound nuisance? I don't know.
Whether or not
like
somebody
it, it's
complains.
A nuisance.
Yeah, that's the problem. There's always somebody who's not going to like it.
Currently, the city of Seattle and the county are the same.
Yeah. But I believe that they're both using the state criteria. Isn't that right, Adam?
They're both built upon the state, yeah.
Yeah, they're based on the state WAC, whatever it is.
173.60.
Pardon?
173-60.
There you go. See, that he knows all this stuff. I don't.
Can I email you?
Pardon?
Can you connect me with Adam?
Sure. This is Adam. That's Dan. Any other questions? Well, thank you all for coming. I'll hang around.
Thank you.
For
thank you.
Do.
What?
Do you need to move chairs?
I don't think so.
It's easy to make a mistake, so I find that it's a good thing.